more day, especially after Tyler saw them together. And then, I remember the boat. There's no way Mr. Lowry had time to move her body before Brooke found him there, alone on the patio. I start to ask the next question, but then I don't have to.
I looked at my father, completely shocked, as I put the pieces together. I screamed at him, "No, no," and then I left him there. I ran across the patio and down the steps to the dock. The water was rough that night, rocking the boats against the moorings. As I ran, I looked in every opening between them, but I couldn't see much farther than that. When I got to the old Woody, the boat I recognized from the summer before, Peter Walsh's boat, I stopped and took two more steps, checking between his boat and the one next to it. And that's when I saw her. Carrie, that's when I saw her. Eve. She was floating, face down. So I screamed and I jumped in the water.
Eve! Eve!
I was kicking as hard as I could as I held her by the waist and pulled her head up. But then we both began to sink. So I grabbed hold of Peter's boat with one hand, my other hand cupped around her chin, trying to hold it above the water. I called out for help, but the sound of the ocean swallowed my cries. I tried to push her up over the side of the boat, but she was so heavy in the water. I turned her on her back, then let go for just a second so I could get over the side. I thought maybe then I would be able to lift her, but I still wasn't strong enough. I let go again, climbed out of the boat, and I went back to find Tyler. I ran down the lawn to the game room, but he wasn't there, and everyone was gone. I was out of my mind, soaking wet, as I ran all the way back to our house, and I found him in his room, curled up on the floor. I grabbed his arm and I told him to come with me, that I needed his help. And together we ran through the trail in the woods back to the inn and then out on the dock to where I had left her body. I was ready to jump back in the water, but as I stood there, in the exact place where I'd left her, I could see that she was gone. I thought at the time that her body had been carried out to the ocean. It was so rough that night.
Wait, that doesn't make any sense. Her clothes were found by the beach the next day. Someone must have moved her body, taken off her clothes and her shoes, wrapped her in an anchor line, and let her sink to the ocean floor.
Yeah, I know.
Do you think your father did that? That he killed her, and then went back and moved her body? Brooke stops talking then, and looks at Tyler, who's staring blankly at the center of the room, as if he's gone somewhere deep inside himself. But then, he speaks.
The boat, it was gone too.
Tyler, no.
Shut up, Brooke. Tyler, tell me, was it Peter Walsh's boat?
Yeah. And we didn't wait for it to come back. We didn't want to know any more than we did. Brooke said there was nothing we could do. She said that if we told anyone, they would take our father away. And that I'd be left with our mother. She said she didn't want that for me.
God, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I was so young. I thought it was the best thing at the time. I thought I was helping you.
And your father? You never asked him? In all these years, you never asked him if he killed your best friend?
Chapter 56. Brooke. Sometimes I wake up and feel Eve's body in my arms. The weight of her, the stillness. No breath moving in and out of her chest, no pulse through her veins. And the part I didn't tell Carrie or Tyler, how she seemed to be looking up at me in the moonlight, or maybe beyond me at the stars. But I could see into those eyes. There was no life inside them. Eve was gone. When you bury something as abruptly and deeply as I did that summer, it's hard to dig it back up. The next morning, after Eve died, I found my father standing on the dock, looking out at the ocean. It was dead calm. He must have felt me behind him because he turned. His face was red and swollen. He hadn't slept all night. Neither had I. I threw my body at his, pounding my fists into his broad chest, asking him over and over,
"Why? Why? Why?"
And he didn't try to stop me. He just stood there perfectly still, whispering the words,
"I'm sorry. I'm sorry."
Chapter 57. Carrie. I'm spent when I leave the inn. I told Brooke and Tyler to go home. I needed to think about what they'd told me, then talk to the prosecuting attorney about how she wants to handle this. I have an obligation to tell her what I've learned, but first, I need to sort it out in my head. There have been so many lies, and the truth is, no one saw Mr. Lowry lay a hand on Eve, except to hold her in his arms. Everything is circumstantial. Brooke didn't admit to anything more than having an affair with Peter Walsh and trying to save Eve's life. As the adrenaline dies down, I'm filled again with the longing to solve Eve's case. I'm not satisfied that I have. I get to the house I used to share with Rob and enter through the side door. I find Rob and Sylvie in the kitchen packing a cooler. Rob promised to take her to the fireworks this year. He'd never asked me to go, knowing the memories this night held for me. Now that we're separated, he's free to do what he wants. Sylvie runs to greet me. I haven't seen her for 3 nights, and I bend down, pull her into my arms, and lift her up so I can feel her body against mine, her heart beating and her blood flowing. When I set her down, she returns to her father and asks me to follow. She wants me to see what they've packed. Rob looks up from the basket with a sad smile. He tells Sylvie that I'm not coming because I don't like the beach at night. Sylvie nods. His eyes run across my face as he kisses her on the top of her head and tells her she should go and grab a sweatshirt in case it gets cold. He tells her to look for something that's red, white, or blue, and she smiles and runs off down the hall to her room. Rob can see that something's wrong. He asks me what's going on, and just like Brooke, I don't know where to begin. So I pull the photo from my jacket pocket, the photo of Eve with the new friends she'd made that summer, including my husband. I walk to where he stands and place it on the counter in front of him. He looks at it, then glances back to me. He asks me what this is, as if he has no idea. "Just look at it." And he does. But still, there's no recognition on his face. "Look closer." And that's when he sees it. He sees himself as a younger man, staring back. I expect him to make excuses, explanations for why he never told me that he knew Eve that summer, and that he knew Peter Walsh and Renee Quinn, and why he's been so insistent that I stop investigating Eve's case. But he doesn't. Instead, he asks me,
Is that the guy from the fishing net?
Peter Walsh. And his wife, Renee. We met her at the morgue.
Oh my God, that is him. And her. When was this taken?
You really don't know? You don't remember the day you stood on the dock at the East Bay Inn with a guy who just turned up dead, his wife, and... Do you really not know who that other girl is standing right next to you?
Care, that was years ago. It must have been the summer some college kids rented a house, right? Up on the interstate. I was friends with a guy who was dating some girl who was living there, Will. I don't even remember her name. But I only came down there for one weekend. I was working at a summer camp up in Maine. This other girl, who is that?
No, don't do this to me. Don't pretend you don't know.
Carrie, I swear to you, I have no idea who this girl is.
It's Eve! Eve Shea! Rob looks back to the picture and stares at the girl standing next to him. He starts to shake his head in disbelief. He pleads with me to believe him. He tells me he met a dozen kids that weekend and that he never went on Peter's boat. They had lunch on the porch at the inn. He remembers having fish and chips and drinking beer, but he doesn't remember Peter Walsh or Renee Quinn or Eve. I remind him that Kayla, Will's girlfriend, was in Renee's sorority.
Again, he says he barely knew Kayla. He was only there this one weekend, hanging out with his friend. I came here filled with indignation, but now he turns it right back at me.
Hold on. Where did you get this picture?
From Renee Walsh.
And what? Did you think that all this time, all these years, that I lied to you about knowing your best friend? Whose death has tormented you? That I married you? Had a child with you?
I don't know, Rob. You told me to stop looking into her case. You made it a condition in our marriage counseling, and then this picture turns up.
I made it a condition along with a lot of other things, Carrie. Not because I didn't want you to find out that I was the one who... What? Do you think I killed her? That our entire marriage was my attempt to cover my tracks?
I don't know what I think. Rob closes his eyes and draws in a long, slow breath to calm his nerves. And for a moment, I think I know this man. That I would know if he was lying, if his anger now is all a part of it. But then, I thought I knew Brooke. I thought I knew Eve. They both kept secrets from me. I decide now to keep a secret from him, that I've taken a hair from Sylvie's brush and sent it to the lab to be tested with the DNA sample from Eve's autopsy. I don't ask myself what it means that I won't believe him until I see the results. Sylvie returns from her room. She's found her red sweatshirt and holds it up for us to see. Rob tells her it's perfect. I smile and nod. If she senses what's happened between us, she doesn't show it. Rob takes the picture from the counter and hands it to me as if it's nothing. And then he tells Sylvie to give me a kiss goodbye.
Chapter 58. Brooke. When I get back to the house, I find it empty. Aiden's car is gone from the garage. There's a note on the kitchen counter that says simply,
I've gone to Jack's to watch the fireworks.
His friend Jack lives one town north of here and is having a party on his private beach. The barge is here in East Bay, but the fireworks can be seen for miles around. Aiden had asked me earlier in the week if I wanted to go, and that had been the plan. He knows how I feel about being here on this day. Last year, I stayed in our room with the shades drawn and my headphones covering my ears while I watched TV. Aiden thought Jack's party would be a way for us to spend this day together, on the water, which he loved, but someplace else. He said maybe we could create new memories together. Jack's girlfriend likes me, and now I've ruined that. It's just past 9. I pour a glass of wine from the bottle he's left on the counter, and I take a cigarette from my stash. I go outside to the front porch. I'm curious at how calm I feel. There's relief at having finally told Carrie the truth about everything. Tyler seemed to feel the same. After Carrie left us in the library, I held him in my arms for a long time. I know the pain he suffered is partially my fault. Still, the calm inside me feels strange. Tyler and I are both suspects in Peter's murder. We'll have to give formal statements. Tyler has to provide an alibi. I, of course, don't have one. Carrie said she's also going to question our father tomorrow about Eve's death. I can't even think about the wrath that will come from our mother. Tyler can't stay there. That's clear to me now. If I can sort things out with Aiden, there's room for him here. And if I can't, who knows? I have enough of my own money to make a new start in New York. I'll bring Tyler with me. It's easy to leave the past behind in New York. I almost did years ago, before I met Aiden. Jesus. It's always men, isn't it? Eve told us once about her mother and how she said things about men and women and something about getting out of our cars. I wish to God I hadn't stopped mine to take this ride with my husband. I take a long sip of wine and a drag on the cigarette. Still, how can I feel this calm after what I did to Aiden and our marriage? I have no idea what happened to the girl I once was, whose heart could be tossed about like those boats on the water with just one look from a man like Jeremy Ashbourne. Jesus. I hear the first firework as I stare into my wine glass. It shakes the ground. It's hard to hide from them when they shoot out over the water like that. And that's when the calm disappears. My brain whispers to me to wake up. The wine, it says. It tastes horrible. I'd thought it from the first sip. Aiden doesn't drink bad wine. But it was open, on the counter. Then I hear another whisper as I take another sip, another drag. The missing wine bottle from the Four Points.
Ah! Holy Mother of God!
I toss the cigarette and race back inside, to the kitchen and the counter where the wine was sitting, just waiting for me with an empty glass beside it. But when I get there, it's gone.
Chapter 59. Eve. His voice wasn't angry when he said,
"You're very late, young lady."
Instead, he sounded amused. Like this was to be expected with a teenage girl. Someone who can't keep track of the time, keep her life in order. He said,
"Come on, let's get started."
I've never felt so much fear in my life. I clung tightly to my purse and forced a smile on my face. My shoes were still dirty, but my hair was straight and my face was clean. I could smell the cherry lip gloss and thought about how this evening started. Me with my two best friends, getting dressed up. Brooke was so excited about spending the night with Jeremy Ashbourne. Carrie had enough anticipation to sneak some of the same lip gloss when Brooke wasn't looking. And I was choosing the red and white striped shirt that now clung to my body as I walked toward the boat in the next slip.
My best friends. My bedroom. The bonfire. It felt like a lifetime ago.
Chapter 60. Carrie. I find my mother waiting for me when I get back to her house. She's wearing a blue checked sundress and sandals. She's straightened her hair and put on makeup. And I realize suddenly that she's had somewhere to go. But she was worried.
Mom, I'm so sorry. I should have called and told you not to wait for me. Where are you off to?
Just across the street. It's no big deal. You look like hell. Ooh, and that young cop, the cute one, he dropped off an envelope. It's on your desk.
Yeah, thanks, Mom. I love you.
I hug her tightly, the way I'd hugged my daughter earlier. She asks what's gotten into me. I tell her it's just been a day. She laughs and says I'm just like my father. That's the same thing he used to say to evade her questions. Then she hurries out the door and across the street, where our neighbors are sitting on their front porch, waiting for the show to begin. The truth is, I'm relieved to be alone. I grab a glass and a bottle of wine from the fridge. I pour more than I should and take it back to my bedroom. I set it down on the desk I used to study at years ago, take off my jacket and my holster with the gun, unclip my badge. I pull my shirt loose, but I don't change. Instead, I open the envelope that Jamie dropped off. I toss the papers that are inside on my bed, along with the photo that I've had in my jacket all day. I take a long sip of wine and resign myself to going through the minutiae that he's gathered. The printouts of Peter Walsh's search history. There are websites about economic data, inflation rates, job numbers. Eve's murder wasn't the only thing Peter had on his mind. He had a family to support and an affair to keep going. I stand by the bed, looking at the stack of documents, then spread them out across the duvet. I let my eyes jump around, taking them in. I see the printout of the photo from Eve's funeral, the one I'd shown to Tyler and Brooke in the library. I pick it up and set it aside, and continue scanning the pages. I don't expect to find anything new. Brooke thought Peter was convinced it was Tyler who killed Eve and moved her body with his boat. But then I see something strange. Pictures of a different boat, not Peter's, but a large catamaran called the Twin Tides. In one of them, it's docked next to Peter's at the inn. I recognize the slips. I stand up and set the wine back down on my desk. Flashes of documents and images are coming at me rapid fire. Frantically, I arrange the pages, setting things next to each other on the bed. The photo from the dock, Peter, Renee, Rob, Jeremy, and Eve. The photo from the funeral that shows Tyler crying. And then, I search my phone for the text message I got from Luke Kendrick after I left his house, listing everyone he saw at the inn the night Eve died. And there it is, right in front of me. Wait. Take this one step at a time. Okay, first, the Twin Tides. That's Aiden Granger's boat. Second, standing in the background at Eve's funeral, in a crowd of faces that are lost to the vivid image of young Tyler Lowry crying, is a man staring at the coffin. Aiden Granger. Third, searches for criminal history on Aiden Granger with the search term statutory rape. And finally, on my phone, Luke Kendrick's list, the third name down, Aiden Granger. Oh my God. And now, I remember that Eve was desperate for money to go to college that summer. Jeremy Ashbourne told me the things she said to him in his car that night. After he told me about Brooke knowing Peter Walsh, he couldn't stop talking. He said it was Mrs. Rosario who had arranged for some kind of loan. And if she told Jeremy, who else would she have told that summer? Peter must have known. He knew to look for all of these things about Aiden Granger after seeing what I am. The boat right next to his that summer. And then, that red and white striped shirt. The one she said was too tight and revealing. The mascara she wore. The plan she'd made with Brooke so she wouldn't have to be home that night. And all of the people who saw her going to the inn. And who saw her when she got there. Aiden's twins were in the game room. I grab my holster with my gun and secure it around my waist. Then, I head back to the car.
Chapter 61. Eve. The Twin Tides was 10 times the size of Peter's boat. It had been moored beside his all summer. Peter said it was called a catamaran, that it could sleep 6 people inside. It even had a kitchen and a bathroom with a shower. Renee said that boat was so big, I wouldn't even need a life vest. Mr. Granger pointed to the ladder and I climbed up, clutching the rail with one hand and my purse with the other. He was standing at the top waiting for me. He had the same smile on his face as the first time we met. It was Mrs. Rosario who introduced us. Mr. Granger was in her investment group. She said she'd known him for years. With one phone call, she was able to get me a meeting. And with that one meeting, I was able to get a loan for the entire first year of college, and a promise for more money if I did well. He said we would keep it informal. I didn't have to sign anything. He said he would pay the money directly to the school for tuition, room, and board. Once I got settled, he said he would send me an allowance to pay for books, to buy cute clothes, get my nails done the way girls like to do, have a little fun with my friends. But not too much, he said with a smile. Mrs. Rosario told me this was how the meeting would go. She said it would be easy the first time, when we met in town at a coffee shop. It was the second meeting, she said, that would be the hard part. And of course, I knew exactly what she meant. Which was why I was not surprised when I felt his hand on the small of my back as I reached the last step on the ladder, and when that hand moved up to my shoulder as I climbed onto the deck. He gave it a squeeze.
Come on, let me show you around. You're gonna have a good time, I promise.
Chapter 62. Brooke. Someone killed Peter Walsh, and it wasn't me. I've been so stupid, so preoccupied with what Peter thought he knew about the night Eve died, how he thought it was Tyler who killed her and moved her body with his boat. I knew something bad had happened to him the day after we were supposed to meet. 2 days later, I called his office from the library payphone and they told me he was missing. Then I found the news clip from Newport about it, the search for the local businessman with a wife and 2 children. It was then Tyler helped me create my alibi using the messages on the Signal app with a man named David Paul. I was terrified that I would be implicated in his disappearance. When his body landed on the deck of the inn and Carrie got the case, like, what are the chances? I made up the story about the things we heard in the room next door. I thought, if I give her an elaborate story and a reason for my lover to disappear, she'd be more likely to believe it. And by then, it was too late to change his name. Of course I thought about who might have killed Peter. I became convinced it was a stranger, someone related to his work, someone he'd scorned along the way, maybe another woman, or a jealous husband, maybe even his own wife. Did I not even care? It occurs to me now that I hadn't thought about Peter Walsh since his body got pulled out of that trawling net. After months of thinking I loved him, that he was a threat to my marriage. Life is so strange, isn't it? Someone killed him with the wine bottle that was on the bar in River 3 that night. Not just someone. When did this thought enter my mind? Was it just now? Or had I suspected it ever since Peter didn't meet me and I came home to find Aiden asleep on the sofa? He never slept on the sofa. He liked to watch TV in bed and fall asleep there. I hadn't walked around to see him. The TV was on, and the blanket was hanging off the arm of the sofa on one end. I didn't actually see Aiden that night, did I? And all the sex I've had to use to distract him. Oh, God. God. Aiden. Where did he go with that bottle?
Looking for this?
Aiden.
I spin around and see him in the doorway, holding the wine that was on the counter. He's wearing his gardening gloves, cradling it from the very top and the very bottom, making sure he doesn't disrupt my fingerprints that are now all over it.
What are you doing, sweetheart? Hiding from the fireworks again? It's hard to believe it's been 15 years. That poor girl. And she was so close to going to college.
Chapter 63. Eve. Mr. Granger gave me a tour of the boat. He was excited to tell me how it worked, how it floated on the two holes connected by a canopy. Most of the space was underneath. He took me there, down narrow steps, and suddenly the ocean completely disappeared, except for the rocking, back and forth, as he poured two glasses of champagne. He handed one to me and clicked it with his own.
Cheers,
he said.
To your future.
I took a small sip, but this upset him. He told me to drink more. He said that I seemed nervous and uptight. He reached out and swept my hair behind my ears.
You're so pretty, sweetheart. Let me see your face.
I put the glass to my lips and drank the entire thing, and then I held it out for him to pour another. I had to be stronger than this. If he thought I was nervous or scared, I knew this wouldn't happen, and I needed that money for college. I kept thinking about what Mrs. Rosario had told me, about exactly what I needed to do. I asked him if I could use the bathroom, and I said it with a big smile. He took my arm and led me to the door. He told me it was technically called a head, but all the girls laughed when he said that. He didn't have to tell me why. The reference the girls found amusing. And even though the fear was still pulsing through my veins, I managed to laugh. Then I stepped inside the head and closed the door, locking it shut. There was a mirror over the small sink. It was the first time I'd seen myself since leaving the bathroom at the arcade, and I thought, I don't even recognize this girl. But then I realized that I did. Carrie always said that people don't change. Whatever had been inside me my entire life, I knew was still there in that moment, and that I could do what had to be done. I shut the lid of the toilet with my foot and placed my purse on it. Then I bent down and pulled out the small tape recorder Mrs. Rosario had given me. I made sure the tape was rewound to the beginning. She said I would have 20 minutes, and that's all. She told me exactly what I needed to say and what I needed him to say. Before I hit record, I remembered what she had told me in her kitchen. How the only way women could get power back from men was with a smile, a hammer, or a clever trick. I didn't have a hammer, and I'd be damned if I would let Mr. Granger make me smile one more time that night. Mrs. Rosario told me he had been doing this to girls for years. She said maybe it was time he paid for it.
And why not pay it to you, Eve? Why not you?
She said she would handle everything after I got the recording. Like that would be the hard part. But I couldn't imagine what could be harder than this. I opened the door to find Mr. Granger standing there. I could see the bed inside, the covers turned down. The smile had left his face. What replaced it was something I never wanted to see again. I walked inside and set my purse on the bed. The zipper was open so our voices would be clearer on the recorder. My movements felt unnatural, my face quivering. I prayed he wouldn't notice. He was standing between me and my exit, out that door, and across the small living room to the stairs, then up to the deck, and down the other side to safety. I could see it, each step in the plan, the path of my escape. Mr. Granger closed the door behind him.
Don't be nervous.
I'm not.
It's not sexy. I don't like it.
I'm sorry. I'll be okay in a minute. I've never done this before.
Yes, you have.
Well, not like this. For money.
It gets easier. You'll see. There are far worse things you'll do in your life.
After tonight, how long before you make the deposit for first semester?
Again, not sexy, Eve.
His voice repulsed me. Who did he think he was, telling me how I should be in a situation like this? Sometimes a person has just had enough, and that was how I felt, in the bedroom on his boat. And after everything that had happened that night, Connor grabbing my arm, not letting go, Luke blocking my way and then following me into the arcade, trapping me in the bathroom, even Jeremy, with his questions about what I was doing, how I was paying for college. Maybe my anger was misplaced, because he was right. I wasn't blackmailing anyone over being pregnant, but that's still what this was. Blackmail. I couldn't believe what I had become. I looked at this man, who made me sick to my stomach. I thought about what this must have been like for the other girls who'd come before me, desperate to get out of their small towns, not seeing another way. I heard my mother, warning me not to get out of my car, not to jump the rail and let some boy drive me in the opposite direction of where I was headed. And I realized suddenly, that's exactly what I was doing. If I went through with this plan, if I blackmailed Mr. Granger to get to college, then what? How would I pay for the next year? I would always be connected to him and Mrs. Rosario. This would always be with me. It didn't matter that I wasn't going to sleep with him. This felt just as filthy. I couldn't do it. I would have to find another way. So I told him.
I made a mistake. I have to go.
I grabbed my purse and zipped it shut, and then I turned and walked toward the door. But Mr. Granger stood in my path, his body twice the weight of mine.
Is this a joke? You made me wait here all night, and now you just want to leave? I don't think so.
Chapter 64. Brooke. I stare at my husband in the doorway as he holds the one piece of evidence that could link me to Peter's death.
How did you know?
You're not a good liar, sweetheart.
Now he's the one lying. I'm an excellent liar.
He called you, didn't he? Peter Walsh. That's how you knew about the affair. He called you and asked about Eve Shay's death. Did he ask about me? And Tyler? That's when you knew, because how else would he know me?
He wasn't very smart. Seriously, Brooke, you could have done better.
And then you figured it out. You followed me to the Four Points that night. You confronted Peter in the room, River 3.
Oh, that place is so fucking pretentious.
Then you got in a fight over me and you killed him. You killed him and then dragged him to the balcony and rolled him into the river. I never heard a thing while I waited for Peter in the room next door.
Aiden looks at me with a sick, twisted smile. Of course he's not going to confess to killing Peter, but I can see that I'm right because he shows no signs of wanting me to say more, to figure out more. And he would. He would want me to know how clever he was.
So what now?
He shrugs his shoulders and meets my stare with one that is equally defiant.
I don't know. Candace, you didn't make it go away, did you?
No. That's the same thing written in that email. That was Aiden, too. He sent the email to me and one to himself with a picture of me and Peter, which means he had watched me and Peter the last time we made love at the Four Points. That's so wrong. Well, I hope he enjoyed the show.
I suppose you could stick around here and find out what happens to you when your old friend, who's Now the chief of police comes for you with handcuffs. Or we could pack our bags and take a little trip. Maybe we could go hiking in Nepal. You said you've always wanted to go.
And what about Tyler? What will happen to my family?
If you really cared about your family, you never would have run away to New York. You and I are just the same. Now come on, be a good girl and pack a bag. Mine's already in the trunk. I'll get the car ready.
He doesn't wait for me to answer. In his mind, I'm out of moves because of that wine bottle. I want to take it from his hands and smash his face with it. But I don't. I walk upstairs to the bedroom to buy myself some time. I feel the same kind of agitation I used to get in high school when my mother caught me in a lie, knowing what she would do to me. How did I get myself in this situation? How did I let this old man outsmart me in my own home, at my own game? And then, as I pull a suitcase from the closet, I think about the last thing he said after mentioning the fireworks. He couldn't believe how long it had been.
That poor girl. And she was so close to going to college.
But how would he know that? I had never mentioned it to him. Jeremy said that it was Mrs. Rosario who had arranged a private loan for her. Everything suddenly comes together. Why Eve was going to the inn that night. Why she never told me or Carrie of her plans. The Granger's boat sitting right there next to Peter's, where I jumped in the water to try to save my best friend. And as I have that memory, another one comes. When I was fighting to keep her head above the water, I could see her eyes, that there was no life in them. There was light shining on her face. It was coming from the hull of the boat beside us, the Twin Tides. Aiden was there that night, on that boat. Oh my God, that's where Eve was going, to see him. That's how she fell in the water. Or maybe he threw her there. It wasn't my father. I'd been wrong all these years. The strange calm that had been with me before returns with clarity about what happened to Eve and to Peter. Aiden didn't confront Peter about having an affair with me, no. He confronted him about the things he'd found out about Eve's death. I throw the suitcase on the bed and open it. I toss in my heaviest shoes and two thick sweaters to keep them from rattling. I zip it up, then carry it down to the garage. As I walk down the stairs with my suitcase, I realize that Aiden must have heard me scream for help that night. Maybe he even watched as I struggled to pull Eve out of the water. When I ran to get Tyler, he scurried down from his boat to Peter's and took Eve out to sea. Aiden thinks he's put an end to what he's done, but he has no idea.
Chapter 65. Eve. Mr. Granger wasn't prepared when I slid under his arm and made it out the door. I imagined in the past he'd been able to be more persuasive with his words and the money he was dangling over the girls who came before me. I ran across the living area to the steps that led up to the deck. As I reached the top, I could feel him grab hold of the rail beneath me. The ladder shook with his weight, and then I was on the deck, and he was right there too. He grabbed me by my hair and spun me around, pinning me against the metal rail. I looked down at the black water. It seemed so far. I told him again that I was sorry, that I just wanted to go home.
I won't tell anyone! I promise!
But then he grabbed my purse and looked inside. He saw the recorder. His face got bright red as he threw the purse into the water, and it slipped under the dock. I didn't care. I wasn't going to blackmail him, and I told him that. I told him I had changed my mind.
Who do you think you are?
Nobody. Nobody. I'm nobody. I just want to go home.
He dragged me then to the other set of steps that led to the dock.
Okay, Eve. Go home. See what happens to you. You'll be working for a man your whole life, one way or another.
When I realized I was free, I started to race down the steps. But then I misread the gap. Terror grabbed hold of me the second my body hit the water. I wasn't far from the edge, but the current was pulling me away. I felt myself slam into Peter's boat, and I reached around, clawing at the side. I kicked my legs, but they moved through the water like it was air, my nails sliding down the slick side of the boat. And then Mr. Granger was there on the side, standing on the edge of the slip, looking down at me. He held an oar in his hand and he reached it out, and I got a burst of hope. After everything that had happened, he was trying to save me. I turned to grab it with both hands and felt it pull me away from Peter's boat, around to the back of the slip. I thought once I reached it, Mr. Granger would pull me out. I felt it jerk and release from my hands. I looked up and saw him clutching it, staring at me in disbelief. Not because I couldn't swim, but maybe because he couldn't believe what he was doing. As I began to slip beneath the water, I turned my eyes from his evil face and looked up at the black sky and the bright stars. I felt everything inside me begin to calm. There was nothing else I could do. I looked at the stars until all of them disappeared except for one, and I heard my mother say my name.
Eve.
All I wanted to do then was to be with her, with my mother. That one star I'd been searching for since the day she died. I felt my mouth open and the water rush into my lungs, her arms reaching out from the sky to hold me.
Chapter 66. Carrie. Aiden Granger. He was never on the radar when they were investigating Eve's death 15 years ago. He hasn't been on mine for the 9 years I've been involved. The box with her files under my desk, the files that were on my computer, sitting right there in front of me day after day. And for as long as I've wanted justice for Eve, all I can think about now is Brooke in that house alone with him. The fireworks are nearing the finale, exploding so loud I can feel them in my chest as I drive toward the beach. I can smell the bonfires and the sulfur drifting off the ocean. The sky is cloudy with the smoke, blackened by it. The moon and stars that had been out earlier covered like a blanket. When I approach the house, I see lights on upstairs, but the rest is dark. My pulse quickens as I pull into the driveway, blocking the garage. As I'm about to get out, I hear the rumbling of the door as the chain pulls it open, and then I see the exhaust from the tailpipe of Aiden's car. My headlights shine through the rear window. There's just one figure inside, in the driver's seat, a figure with long brown hair. I walk slowly toward the garage. When the taillights come on, I call out,
"Brooke, stop!"
I see her in the driver's seat, staring straight ahead. I knock on the window, and after a moment, she rolls it down. She looks stunned as she turns off the ignition, but my eyes are drawn to the passenger side and a large hammer that sits there next to her Chanel bag.
Brooke, where's Aiden?
She doesn't answer. Instead, she pops the trunk, and suddenly, I know what she's done. I make my way toward the back of the car. I can hear Brooke step out and walk to where I stand. I place my hand on the trunk door, slightly ajar, then slowly lift it up, revealing what's inside. Two suitcases, and lying on top, Aiden Granger's body.
Brooke!
I reach down to his neck and feel for a pulse. It's still there. I can see blood coming from his head. I start to call for help. There's time to save him. Brooke reaches out and grabs my hand, pulling the phone away from my mouth.
Brooke! There's still time. He's still alive.
She looks at me and slowly shakes her head, side to side.
Carrie, he killed Eve.
I know. I know.
And for a moment, I was right there with her, wanting this justice for Eve, wanting more than that, wanting revenge. But in the end, it wasn't in me.
Not like this, Brooke. Not like this.
Chapter 67. Carrie. Sometime later. Aiden Granger survived. He confessed to killing Peter Walsh, though he claims it was in the heat of the moment. That he followed Brooke to the Four Points Hotel and lost his mind when he realized she was having an affair. No one can prove that Peter Walsh confronted him about Eve's death. And he denied any wrongdoing. He said he never saw Eve that night. It's going to be a tough case for the state's attorney. I try not to think about that. Instead, I focus on what it means for Brooke that he's alive. She was able to claim self-defense, which is a much easier road to travel when the charge isn't murder, even if his story, like all the others she's told, is a lie. Given what he did to Peter Walsh, and allegedly to Eve Shea, the assault by his wife was not going to garner any sympathy. I asked Brooke what she was going to do when she left her garage that day, where she was going with her husband's body. But she never told me. Now, it's just one of those things that will have to remain a mystery. We were able to find Peter Walsh's car in a dump not far from East Bay, the same one used by Aiden's construction company. One of his workers admitted to driving him back to his car that night, parked just up the road from the Four Points Hotel. Brooke said that when she came home that night, she thought Aiden was sleeping on the sofa. The TV was on in the room, but she never walked in to check on him. She was relieved that she didn't have to see him, being so worried about why Peter never showed up. As for Eve, Mrs. Rosario was able to fill in some of the missing pieces, though she swore on her life that she never thought Eve's death had to do with Aiden Granger. She didn't even know they'd made a plan to meet that night. If she had, of course she would have come forward. She admitted to setting up a meeting between Eve and Aiden Granger, and that she knew he was likely to expect things from her in exchange for helping with her college tuition. She and Eve had devised a plan to expose him, but she'd left the rest up to Eve. That's all she knew. I asked her what she was thinking, suggesting that an 18-year-old girl do something so risky. She just shrugged as if to say, why not?
There had to be justice. Men think they can get away with anything. And Eve, well, she was a clever girl, wasn't she?
When she said Eve's name, there was something in her voice. Disdain, maybe. And it made me wonder how much of her was really motivated by a desire to seek justice and address the imbalance of power between the sexes. She told me how men tried to keep it for themselves, locked away in rooms only they could enter. For her whole life, she felt like she was forced to stay in the room next door. I almost asked her if the room was called River 3. When she was done explaining herself, I couldn't help but wonder if all of this was simply because of the fact that Eve Shea had broken her son's heart. We'll never know exactly what happened on that boat. But Mr. Lowry, when finally asked about that night, said he was horrified to learn that his own children thought he might be capable of hurting Eve. He said that he went to look for her after she ran off, and again about half an hour later. That time, he was just halfway down the dock when he saw her purse floating in the water in one of the empty slips. He reached for it, but couldn't grab hold before it washed away with the current. That was why his shirt was soaking wet when Brooke touched it. I don't know what it will mean for the Lowry family, now that this has all come to the surface, except that Tyler has moved out of their garage apartment. Brooke offered for him to move back with her to New York, where she planned to start over. But Tyler said East Bay was his home, and now that he finally knew what happened to Eve, and that it wasn't their father who had killed her or watched her die, he could live with himself. The guilt had lifted. Mrs. Rosario had a request for me in the aftermath. She wanted to know if we ever found out who had gotten Eve pregnant. She didn't think Eve had any idea. She never mentioned it, and she was hell-bent on going to college that fall. I told her that, so far, all of the DNA we had submitted had come back without a match. And that was true, including the hair from Sylvie's brush, which meant that Rob could not have been the father. Mrs. Rosario asked me if I would do the same with a hair she'd taken from the bathroom she shared with her husband, and I agreed. Weeks later, that test came back positive, but for a grandparent, Mrs. Rosario seemed both sad and relieved to know that Connor was the father of Eve's baby and not her husband. She asked me then if I could tell whether it was a girl or a boy, and that's when I lied. I couldn't let her have one more piece of Eve Shay. That left me and Rob. He put on a good front while all of this was unwinding, playing the dutiful first selectman, making appropriate statements about longtime resident Aiden Granger and his wife, Brooke Lowry, who had even deeper ties to the community. We spoke only of the case during these weeks, and I felt a softening in his voice, a hint of the playfulness between us, which I missed so much. I hoped it meant he was coming to understand why I did what I did. I had hurt him deeply with my accusations, but I'd felt justified in making them. I think I still do. There were only 5 people in that photo, and he had been so insistent that I stopped looking into Eve's case. Still, I keep thinking, in spite of what my mother told me, about what it says when circumstantial evidence can so easily tip the scale, make you believe horrible things about your own husband. And if that's the case, what is the point of trying to stay together? This is what I'm thinking as I drive to our house with the results from the DNA test. I walk down the driveway and knock quickly on the side door before entering. Rob is in the kitchen gathering his things. He looks up, and in his eyes, I see the injury I inflicted the last time I was here, sliding that photo in front of him on the kitchen island. This time, I place an envelope there. It's from the lab, the DNA results. I know it's negative because I read it. He knows because he didn't really know Eve Shay. He doesn't reach for it. He doesn't open it. I shrug as if to say, "What now?" He knows I don't regret anything I did to solve Eve's case or to help Brooke Lowry. He sighs with a heavy breath, then looks up.
You bringing those DNA results to counseling this week?
When he smiles the slightest smile, it steals my breath. And suddenly, I have the answer. Whatever love is left between us, it's enough.
Chapter 68. Brooke. Sometime later. I leave East Bay on a sunny day. I'd said goodbye to my father, telling him again how sorry I was for believing what I did all these years. I'd stopped by the East Bay luncheonette where Tyler still wants to work, pouring coffee, even though I've offered him better opportunities with me in New York. I'd given him one last hug. Earlier that week, I'd made a trip to Newport to sit face to face with Renee Walsh. I told her how sorry I was about rekindling my relationship with Peter, if you could call it that. Technically, I barely knew his name back then. Of course, she's devastated by the loss of her husband. Overall, minus the infidelities, he was a good man, and I wish I felt sorrier about what happened to him. I wish I felt more about a lot of things. After all of that, I meet Carrie on the beach where we had the bonfire 15 years ago, the last place we were all together, me, Carrie, and Eve. We sit in the sand, holding our knees like we're still teenagers, looking out at the ocean as it crashes in and rolls back out. I hope to God this is the last time I have to hear it. I bought an apartment in Midtown, as far from both rivers as you can get in New York. It's quite big, my new apartment. My lawyer says I have a good chance of fighting the prenup with Aiden. Even though I cheated, he killed my best friend and my lover. Then he tried to frame me, and according to my version of events, tried to kidnap me from my own home until I struck him in the head with a hammer. Sometimes that's the only way. Carrie asks me what I might do now, if I might write another novel. I laugh then and say my storytelling days are over. I only had one book in me. The book I had to write after that night I was in the water holding Eve, kicking with all my might to stay above the surface, cupping her head with my hand,
and staring into those beautiful eyes that had gone somewhere else. I don't think I'll ever stop seeing them. I tell Carrie, as we're getting up to leave, brushing the sand from our legs.
You know, at the end of my book, the girl who nearly drowns in the water suddenly opens her eyes and draws in a long breath. Then she runs away from all the madness in her small town, the toxic air of human nature. Men and women breathing it in and out, infusing it with their ignorance.
Carrie nods and stares at the ocean.
None of us deserved her.
You should read it sometime, my novel.
Because in my story, the missing girl is beautiful and pure of heart, and they feed on her like a school of ruthless sharks. In my story, she runs away and finds peace in a foreign land with a handsome stranger. In my story, the girl gets to live.
This has been an Audible original, produced by Audible, written by Wendy Walker, performed by Julia Whalen, Elizabeth Evans, and B.B. Wood, with Dan Bittner, Damon Dono, Josh Hamilton, Bernadette Quigley, Andrea Siglowski, John Bellman, Laura Dreyfus, Aiden Minks, Imani Jade Powers, Melanie Moore, Quentin Earl Darrington, Finn Argus, Brian Altimus, Niall Bullock, Devin Druid, Mercedes Herrero, Jamie Andrews, Kayla Carlson, Ariana Notar Tommaso, CJ Wilson, D. Rossioli, Amy Coombe, Lily Marajnik, Michael Ciro, Fiona McGee, Chris Israel, Jordan Lage, Jacob Moskowitz, Noah Livingston, Henry Sirota, and Kevin T. Collins. Executive producer for Audible, Matthew Patterson. Executive producer, Wendy Walker. Directed and produced by Kevin T. Collins. Produced by Joe Reese. Music supervisor, Michael Beliveau. Edit, sound design, mix and master by Mark Galoop and Real Audiobooks. Head of production at Audible Studios, Mike Charzik. Head of creative development at Audible, Kate Navin. Chief content officer, Rachel Giazza. Copyright 2025 by Wendy Walker. Sound recording copyright 2025 by Audible Originals, LLC. Someone, somewhere, somehow is waiting just to change your life.
Hi, this is Wendy Walker, author of The Room Next Door. My new novel, Blade, comes out on January 6th, 2026. It's a twisty, pulse-pounding thriller set in the world of competitive figure skating and drawn from my own experience training at an Olympic facility in Colorado as a teenage girl. I'm so thrilled that it will be performed by Julia Whalen and B.B. Wood, who you just heard as Brooke and Eve in The Room Next Door. You can pre-order Blade now so you'll be sure not to miss it. If you enjoyed listening, please let us know by leaving a rating or review. And thank you for joining me here on Audible.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.